All right, so we're in Arlee, Montana. We're all done with Sepp's visit. I'm here with Neil Bertrando, the desert rat. You said that one time, I'm never going to let it go.
I know. I might need to make a shirt or something, a little desert rat embroidery to carry the name on.
So we stopped off at the thousand Garden of a Thousand Buddhas thing, and it's still under construction. And I came by here a year ago and gave him some advice. And we did see a hugelkoser bed, which has been abandoned. What was growing in that bed, Neil?
Oh, it looked like mostly your standard weeds, some hoary cress, and a couple of thistles were in there, some grass. not any food. It doesn't look like it was ever planted with food.
Yeah, I think they kind of built it and let it go, which is a little unfortunate. And it does look like it's smaller than the last time I saw it last year. But it's like being fresh off of Sepp's workshop, the thing that strikes me, you got two gardeners out there working their butts off, moving irrigation pipe, and they got their plantings, and clearly they're not following any of the advice I gave them. I even made a suggestion that they got eight gardens, they got an eight-spoked wheel thing, and they're going to make eight gardens, and each one's going to be different. I suggested that one of them be a permaculture garden, and they thought that would be ugly. And so they're going with Purdy, which is basically what I call making Mother Nature be your personal bitch. And they're doing, and it's kind of like, which is kind of funny, because they got a statue in the middle, which apparently once was described to me as like the Buddhist version of Mother Nature. And I was kind of thinking like, sends the wrong message, I think.
I would agree with that.
But after all this time with Sepp, I could just see Sepp coming down there and yelling at these people, saying catastrophe. Actually, all of this trip, he never once said catastrophe. He would say catastrophen. So we heard catastrophen about every minute or so, every 2 minutes.
Something with at least once per dialogue that he went on.
So he would say catastrophin a lot based on what we just saw. And of course, it's very unnatural. They are irrigating. They are planting. They got a lot of plastic mulch, and they got wood chips on the plastic mulch. And it's very monocrop-esque. So it was kind of depressing. But actually, I want this podcast to be something about something else. I just wanted to mention what we just saw and how it's kind of painful to see. Especially this fresh after, you know, time with Sepp. But I wanted, so for a lot of the trip, I got sick one day, and then it's like I should have probably stayed home 3 or 4 days, but instead I took my diseases to share with everybody. And I went in, and I could sit, but I really couldn't go and jump in on the work that was going on. Neil, however, worked a lot. And so we just had somebody asking us, well, what was planted in those hugelkoser beds? And I started to answer, but Neil jumped in because Neil was actually there hip deep in the dirt. So Neil, tell us what was planted and like what kind of spacing and stuff.
You bet, Paul. Well, first of all, I just want to describe the hugelkoser bed real quick. You know, it was maybe 7 or 8 feet wide and also about 7 feet tall. And really steep sides. You know, nothing flat or lumpy. It was a steep wedge that was going up into the air. And my understanding is that this allows you to have a high diversity of plant needs served in a small area. So at the bottom you plant the wetter stuff, and the top you plant the drier stuff. And so that way you can plant all sorts of garden plants and berries and fruits in the same area on that hugelkoser bed. And so we planted raspberries near the top, because they don't like wet feet, and at an angle out of the bed so they can droop over and you can pick them off of the canes like they're like an umbrella, comes right down to you. We planted currants closer to the bottom, and we planted, you know, several hundred to over 1,000 of each of those plants on about 6 foot or 7 foot centers all the way down all the beds. And then we planted in between those strawberries and garlics and shallots. We put potatoes in the tops and the bottom, lots and lots, a few hundred pounds of potatoes, over 100 pounds of shallots and garlics. we seeded at the bottom of the beds with beans and cucumbers and squash and melons. And then we seeded in the center of the bed and to the higher parts of the bed also with the beans and the corn, because they do a little bit better with the drier stuff. In the top of the bed, along the top, we planted Jerusalem artichoke or sunchoke. We also seeded with all sorts of small seed stuff here. A lot of your typical garden species that you would grow. We planted both the warm and the cool season crops all at the same time. We did tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, again, the cucumbers that we talked about before, and the squashes and melons. We planted radishes, kales, collards, carrots, beets, chard, arugula, lettuce, spinach. We planted dill, cilantro, parsley, you know, a whole huge list of basically annual vegetable crops, you know, but all different types, all mixed together. We mixed the small seeds in one bucket and the large seeds in another bucket so that you could get even seeding distribution, and they were all broadcast seed by hand. The ones that we put in, we poked the larger seeds into the ground, the squashes, cucumbers, and then the beans, corn, those sorts of stuff. So the larger seeds in the bucket would have been like your chards and your beets and that, and spinach, that size seed range. Then along some of the lower beds that were next to the water, we planted things like rhubarb and horseradish, a bunch of fruit trees, cherries, peaches, plums, nectarines, what else, pears, I think some apples, and those we planted on about 12-foot spacing, 15-foot spacing on the big trees, and then in between all of everything we filled in with the understory plants, a watercress, comfrey, all sorts of stuff. So nowhere did we plant single species for a whole area. We just interplanted everything in dense polyculture form.
How much irrigation system did you put in?
Well, there's a lake next to it, and that was it. There's water nearby, basically. No pipes, no spray, no pumping, no nothing as far as actual directly putting time and energy into irrigating the area.
And for the whole design, how much fertilization did you lay down, or will there be?
I guess the logs that we put inside the center of the helioculture bed could be considered fertilizer, but that would be the extent of it. On the top of the bed, we laid branches and stuff against the bed to give it some shading and some mulch, and then we, on top of that, scattered some straw mulch so that it will be mulched and protected from moisture, and that might break down into fertilizer at some point also. But other than that, we added no granular fertilizer or materials from off-site like you would maybe see in a standard organic farm, like fish meal or kelp meal or bone meal or chicken manure or anything like that. We added none of that.
And for your knowledge of how Holzer permaculture works, how much fertilizer will be put down later?
Whatever grows there.
So zero. I mean, you know, that's what I'm fishing for. I kind of thought the answer. I thought I knew the answer. Zero. How much irrigation? Zero. How much pest control will there be? Zero. So basically, you know, my understanding is that we've planted it. It's all been built there. And when I say we, I mean, you know, Neil and some others. Not me. I was sitting on my ass pointing and laughing. Look at those people work down there.
There are about 40 people planting it, though, over the course of 3 or 4 days.
Yeah. So that was one thing that I thought was a little different than last time. It's like all the workshop participants, it's like, now go down there and plant stuff. All right, we talked for a while. I told you some stuff. Now everybody get together and go plant some stuff.
Yeah, he was emphasizing practical work as part of your learning, you know, getting that hands-on understanding of what it feels like to do it. And that way, you know, if you make a mistake or do it a way that is not discussed, he can come along and show you and directly demonstrate, here's the little nuance that you didn't do right, and here's how to fix it. So I got a lot of value out of that hands-on, even though I've done a lot of that stuff in the past also.
What was your favorite part of these 11 days with Sepp?
I think my favorite part was just kind of having my mind exploded by what's possible. Being able to see the land transform to the extent that it did, and then also to see some of the pictures of the projects that he's doing worldwide, which are encompassing, you know, hundreds to thousands of acres, and where he's bringing back large ponds all over the landscape in really dry areas, and just
rehydrating the desert to allow forests and food gardens and everything to grow without a lot of inputs. You know, not really plastics or fertilizers or fossil fuel inputs once you get the system in place.
So now, John was saying that he asked Seb four different times this one question, and he never got a straight answer. And I know what my answer to John was, but let me throw it at you and see and watch you squirm a bit with this one. And so the question was, how do you read the land?
Yeah, that's a rough one. I don't think you can be totally taught how to read the land. You know, you need to experiment and do things on the landscape to see how it responds.
So now, my answer to him is that during the PDC, one of the things Skeeterhead folks do was that you go out to a patch of land and you take with you a piece of paper, and you do not move from that patch of land until you have filled the piece of paper with all your observations about that spot. And I think that's one way, that's going to be one of the observed things. And I also think, so I took John out to the, I made a podcast earlier about a cherry tree that had worms, and I took John out to that tree. And it seems to me like the longer I sat there and didn't say anything, and I said, tell me what you see. And then he told me, and then I said, keep going. And I said, keep going about nine times until he finally got to the thing that I wanted him to see, which is that there's ants on the tree. But it's like, you know, I think patience is a huge ingredient. And I think if you're going to say, I'm not moving from the spot until I fill this piece of paper, that's one thing that kind of digs at some of that patience. And then once you start getting to the bottom of the piece of paper, you're starting to notice things that you did not notice in the when you're at the top of the piece of paper. And I think that's a big part of it. The next thing is rather than just looking at one chunk, you got to go out and see a couple of hundred and do this. And then you start to get better at reading the land. And then I think it also helps to have somebody sitting there with you. I mean, it's pretty much impossible to have a dialogue with Seb Holzer, but you could get yourself, you know, Neil Bertrando. There's other permaculture folks out there that are awesome.
Like Paul Wheaton?
Maybe. And then you start to get a little idea like, well, you know, if you want to build, let's say we want to build a pond. What are some different sites we can put the pond in, and why do we want to put them there? And let's start exploring them. And then I think a lot of the stuff starts to come to you. And the longer you're there, the more optimized your ideas become. And it's a matter of time. So yeah, I don't think it's something that can be taught. But there are ways to experience it faster. And the way to experience it faster is to experience it slower.
and look at many different locations over that with that enduring patience of observation. So you basically need a set of tools to gain the experience. You can't really teach someone to read the landscape, but we can provide them with those tools like you described where you can gain the experience needed to read it.
Right, right. All right, Neil, anything else to add?
No, I'm looking forward to going and reading some more landscape in Oregon. I think we're going to maybe put together a key line class there later this year, hopefully.
Oh, my. What part of Oregon?
I'm going to go to Portland and hopefully also down to Bend. So we may do one class at each location or do one year and one the next year.
Right. You did a key line demonstration on this round, this PDC, and then you taught your key line stuff twice, once during the PDC and once during the SEP thing in the evening, right?
That's correct, yeah.
There's the edge of the road, just in case you're looking for it. Don't podcast and drive. Today's lesson. All right, I think on that note, if you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about polyculture, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.